or building bridges.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Fight for 15 embraces Me Too movement in striking McDonald's.
Washing the floors to send you to college. Staying at home so you can feel safe. What do you think is the soul of the knowledge? What do you think that makes her feel safe? Biting her lips and lowering her eyes to make sure there's food on the table. What do you think would be her surprise if the world was as willing as she's able?
One day I went into work.
I was coming into work.
On the night shift.
I was taking orders.
I was at the sink.
He would physically grab me by the waist. He would come up from the back. He would just always be touching you.
He would ask me for pictures of myself.
He would talk about just different sexual activities.
He would ask me if I want to meet up with him.
Ask me, what position do I play in the bedroom?
He got up behind me.
She proceeded to stick her hand in between my legs.
Pointed at his genitals.
Showed me photos of her body.
Pulled me in, shut the door, and tried to kiss me.
Follow me to the bathroom.
My supervisor has touched my behind.
Always slapped my ass.
Grabbing my waist. Tried to kiss me.
Touched me with her hand.
Would touch my breast.
Grab my leg.
Grab my arm.
Grab me like real roughly.
Grab
touching.
Rubbing up. No, this is not okay.
And I tell him to stop and he keep doing it.
And the only thing I could do was push him off.
Tell him to stop.
I told him stop.
I went outside and cried.
And if you tell him to stop, he'll be like, oh, you know you want it.
They know how to corner you in.
I moved different stores.
Asked for at least a change of location.
End up working somewhere else.
I requested different hours.
I just didn't feel safe.
I just kind of stayed quiet.
I didn't know who to talk about it or how to go about telling someone.
I reported at least 5 or 6 times.
I reported to the general manager that day.
Spoke to the GM about the situation and let her know what was going on.
I didn't want to tell them because I was afraid of losing my job.
The owner got mad because I called him while he was in church.
He said, it's pretty much my word against yours.
That it was my fault.
Get used to it or it is not the workplace for you.
He did absolutely nothing.
You either go along with the flow or work somewhere else.
The store manager did not do anything.
There was nothing done.
And she did nothing about it at all.
Nothing happened.
Nothing changed. It seemed like it got a little worse.
I went to the corporate and I wrote to the corporate and I called to the corporate.
They were against ours and they made that very clear when I first started working there.
It happens every day.
Emboldened by the Me Too movement, McDonald's workers stage a one-day strike at restaurants in 10 cities to pressure management to take stronger steps against sexual harassment in the workplace. Organizers say it will be the first multi-state strike in the U.S., specifically targeting sexual harassment.
We will analyze the significance of this development in the context of the Me Too movement, women's labor history, and the growing activism and unionism of low-wage workers in the U.S. and around the world.
We're pleased to have Annalise Orlik, professor of history at Dartmouth College and author of We Are All, Yes We Are, Fast Food Workers Now, the Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. And we are particularly interested in doing this piece, and we'll be focusing more on sexual harassment in the workplace because we have our own contradictions right here that we have to get management to respond to. So we want to educate, agitate, and organize on this critical issue. So Annalise, how are we first to understand what constitutes sexual harassment? We heard this little clip previously, which was essentially sexual in nature, very pronounced and demonstrative. But is that the full composition and reality of what the workers face when they are confronted with offensive gender-based behavior?
No. Obviously, there's a wide range of behavior that creates a hostile environment. That's what the law defines as sexual harassment, creating a hostile environment for women in the workplace. And there are a range of activities that do that. The women in the McDonald's complaints that were filed last May with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and this is 9 cities, 15 complaints, they talked about actual touching. And touching, coming up from behind and grabbing a woman's genitals, rubbing up against her with the man's genitals, kinds of things that really border on sexual assault or constitute sexual assault. So that's one end of the range. And, you know, in some cases there may have been more serious assaults in bathrooms where supervisors follow women workers into the bathrooms, in alleyways at the end of the day, and women workers have faced a lot of retaliation for reporting these activities. But there are other things that constitute sexual harassment. Sexual comments made day after day, all day long, about a woman's appearance, about what you kind of behavior you might want to engage in with her. And of course, the supervisor makes these comments, then other workers feel that they can, and often customers do too. For almost half of women in restaurants and in fast food in particular, they're dealing with this, as one of the women in your clip just said, every day. That's part of their work life, every single day.
And we're used to hearing about sexual harassment by the muckamucks, the Trumps and the Kavanaughs, but this is about workers of the world. This is about the workers, in this case of McDonald's, who are doing a one-day strike. Comment on that and significance of that.
Me Too began to get attention when some famous actresses went after a very famous Hollywood producer in the Harvey Weinstein case. But in fact, this McDonald's strike is one part of a very broad movement by working women, particularly low-wage workers, around the world to fight sexual harassment. And so, yes, this is the first multi-city strike to foreground sexual harassment, and it's one of the first strikes against sexual harassment in a century. But what's been happening for the past few years is that tomato pickers, field workers in Florida, have been highlighting what they call rape in the fields. And a number of them from the Coalition of Immokalee Workers went on a hunger strike this past March in front of the offices of Wendy's in New York because Wendy's had not signed on to this fair food program they've created that has given them a lot more ability to fight sexual harassment in their workplaces by having the big buyers of tomatoes, the Walmarts, the Taco Bells, the Whole Foods, sign an agreement that they would pay more for tomatoes from growers who allowed workers to organize, who took care of sexual harassment complaints by getting rid of the harassers and settling with the workers who guaranteed safer conditions. So there's field workers who've been organizing, hotel workers in Chicago, in Miami, in Seattle, in California, have organized for local ordinances that they call hands on, hands off. And what that did is it mandated that hotel housekeepers could get panic buttons. So if they were assaulted or threatened in one of the rooms where they worked, and that's the industry where it happens to more workers than in any other, some crazy numbers, like estimates between 2/3 and 3/4 of hotel housekeepers have faced sexual harassment or assault, unwanted touching. So those panic buttons would allow workers to immediately reach hotel security and management. But these ordinances go farther. And, you know, in negotiation with Unite Here, with the Hotel Workers Union, they've come up with regulations saying that hotel management has to deal with these issues. They can't retaliate against the workers for reporting them, and they have to sanction, whether it's hotel guests or supervisors, it has to be zero tolerance. Now, what's interesting is that just recently, as a result of the beginning of these laws, five of the large hotel chains have said they're going to start supplying their hotel housekeepers with panic buttons. So, you know, one of the things that's happened with the McDonald's workers before, with the hotel workers, is that these campaigns sometimes result in voluntary action by the corporations. And that's, I think, what the McDonald's workers are hoping for from McDonald's corporate. McDonald's has a policy, but they don't enforce it. And women who try to make franchisees or corporate enforce that zero tolerance policy find themselves out of a job, or their pay is docked, or their hours are docked, or they're treated worse, and that's why they're going on strike.
So there's a high level of retaliation. I want you to just dive a little deeper into what low-income workers in particular face. You mentioned the coalition of Immokalee worker women who were protesting against Wendy's. You've mentioned the McDonald's workers. But the specific circumstances and what it means for people who are really low-wage workers and have very, very little power in this society, and that is generally coupled by their gender reality as well as, I dare say, very oftentimes, the racial disparities that exist in this society.
Yeah, absolutely. The majority of low-wage workers in the world are women, and a majority are people of color. This is true in fast food in the United States. Field work, it's not actually true. Field work is one of those low-wage areas where the majority are still men. But men are not facing sexual assault in the fields. Women are, and it's quite endemic. Then you have garment workers. Recent AFL-CIO studies of the garment industry around the world have shown that, you know, women in the garment trades, very low-paid places like Bangladesh and Cambodia and Ethiopia, are facing incredible rates of being not just sexually assaulted but beaten on the job if they're not working fast enough. And so those folks are organizing too. And last November 25th was an action that was kind of similar to what the McDonald's workers are going to do. It was a multi-country action to protest gender-based violence in the workplace. And they are trying to get the International Labor Organization to pass a convention mandating zero tolerance for sexual violence and sexual harassment in the workplace. And if that happens, different countries ratify these ILO conventions, and then it's national law in those countries. And that's why garment workers have been taking that tack. So I think what you're seeing is that, you know, we've only heard about a handful of famous actresses saying, you know, Me Too and reporting the behavior, the inappropriate, the illegal, the criminal behavior of powerful men. But in fact, this is something that's going on all over the world and particularly facing low-wage workers. And as for what you talked about, the relationship of their wages to this issue, yeah, these are single moms very often. They can't afford to have their pay docked. They can't afford to have their hours docked. They can't afford to, you know, pay a babysitter and then go into work and have the manager say, oh, you reported me, you can go home now. There's no give. You know, we have a moment in this country where 50% of workers make under $30,000 a year. That is poverty wages. 70% of American workers make under $50,000 a year. They're barely making ends meet. So to face harassment and face retaliation for reporting it is really, you know, endangers their stability and the stability of their families. And I want to stress that that gives you a sense of how much courage it takes.
We're speaking with Annalise Orlock, professor of history at Dartmouth College and author of We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. And let's get into the issue of the strike. But at first, I want to say that this isn't the first time McDonald's has been cornered, has been accused of sexual harassment. So I wonder if you can give us the ongoing context for this targeting of, appropriately, of McDonald's.
There was another complaint that was leveled by McDonald's workers, by a number of them in different cities, in 2016. And McDonald's did nothing, despite the fact that they claim, now they're saying they're going to bring in trainers from RAIN, which is a very important network that helps women to deal with sexual assault and sexual abuse. That's not a bad thing. That is a response that McDonald's is taking now based on, you know, the organizing of their workers and the publicity they've already gotten and the suits they've already brought. But it also based on something else that is worth mentioning, and that is that 2 years ago, these fast food workers who've been organizing since 2012 won a victory in the National Labor Relations Board when they ruled that McDonald's corporate could be considered a joint employer with their franchise owners, because McDonald's corporate always says, we can't be held responsible for sexual harassment, we can't be held responsible for workers getting hurt on the job, we can't be held responsible for people not being paid for all the hours they work, because those are franchise owners, they're small business owners, we have nothing to do with them. Well, these workers in Fight for 15 and the McDonald's fast food workers movement, you know, brought a successful case 2 years ago in which NLRB said, no, in fact, there's all kinds of reasons why McDonald's.
And let me just say, that's National Labor Relations Board. So I'm sorry, just wanted to make that clear. Not everybody knows that, but continue,
I'm sorry,
please.
Yes. The National Labor Relations Board. And they, you know, that was created after the National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935, and that law is still hanging on by a thread. It is still the law of the land, although for how long, who knows. So they are considered joint employers. Now, the new Trump appointee on the National Labor Relations Board issued guidance saying that this should be reconsidered, and you know, so it's questionable for how long McDonald's will continue to be held responsible for how workers are treated in their franchises. But because the new Trump appointee had been involved in the case to try to prevent that original ruling that McDonald's could be considered a joint employer, he had to recuse himself. So for now, McDonald's corporate can still be held responsible under the law for conditions in their franchises.
In addition to the book that we mentioned in opening up the sequence, you've also written a book called Rethinking American Women's Activism.
Yes.
How do you place the position of where we are right now, or where women are right now, in terms of activism versus what happened before?
What's really interesting is I end that book with the words of one of the early McDonald's organizers, actually a Kentucky Fried Chicken organizer, but one of the early organizers of the fast food workers movement, Naquasi LeGrand, who in 2012 was 22 years old and had to commute between three jobs to make ends meet, to help her grandmother make ends meet, living far out in Brooklyn in Canarsie and having to commute hours and hours to all of her jobs. She did two things that reminded me of the past, and I closed that book with this. She quoted Fannie Lou Hamer, the famed sharecropper who said in the 1964 Democratic Convention, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. And she talked about that a lot. And a lot of the young, especially African-American workers in the fast food movement, quote Fannie Lou Hamer, and they believe that they are inheritors of the legacy of the civil rights movement. I spoke to two young fast food workers in Tampa, Florida, Blue Rainier and Rika Mack, who were a man and a woman in their 20s, and they said they absolutely feel like they're standing on the shoulders of their grandparents. And they were even trained by some of the 1960s activists when they went down to Georgia. Then there is the way in which Naquasi LeGrand, talking about connecting with other women on the picket lines and other workers around the world through this struggle, you know, made her feel a sense of community as a woman of color, as a worker. And I closed that book, Rethinking American Women's Activism, by saying how much she sounds like Clara Lemlich, a garment striker from 1909, whose speech set off a big, massive strike of workers across the country. And in 1912, one of those groups of women struck over sexual harassment. In fact, that was the very first strike that I have ever found where sexual harassment was the prime issue. So, in many ways, I feel that these workers today are connected to the activists of past decades and even past centuries.
Talk about the organizing that went on for this strike and what specifically the women who are going out in 10 cities demanding against McDonald's.
Well, they organized through women's committees. And I think that we're seeing a lot of that in organizing in the new labor movement, right? Women, it's almost like the consciousness-raising groups of the women's movement 40 years ago, right? We're seeing women talking to each other about the issues they face, realizing that they're not alone, realizing that their anger can be channeled. It's very much the way Fight for 15 has organized. You know, there's a lot of criticism that, you know, some of it's top-down and all that. But in fact, there's a lot of grassroots discussion among workers, you know, who come to see their place as part of a movement. So they are demanding many things. They are demanding that McDonald's enforce their zero tolerance for sexual harassment policy. They want to see managers sanctioned who are involved in this, if not fired. They're also, once again, talking about a living wage and talking about a regular schedule. Now, New York City is one place where the city council did mandate that workers had to be told their schedule 2 weeks in advance, but in most places, McDonald's workers are not. They're scheduled by algorithm. The computer tells them when they can come and when they can go, and they never know what their hours are going to be. So all of these things, living wage, union rights, but in this case, first and foremost, a safe workplace, free of sexual harassment, free of unwanted touching, free of sexually explicit comments, is what they are demanding.
How important do you think Me Too has been in giving courage, raising up these issues to the broader public, which is creating an environment where more people in the low-wage workers' areas can speak out and come to the foreground over this absolutely critical issue to their very identity, being, and personage?
I think that Me Too is getting these workers more attention. You know, Me Too has resulted in the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund, in which some of these wealthy Hollywood women who have become involved in the movement have donated large sums of money to provide legal assistance to low-wage women workers who can't afford it, the money to hire lawyers themselves. So I think in all of those ways, this movement has been very beneficial to low-wage workers. But I want to be clear, low-wage workers started this struggle first.
I was waiting for you to say that. Please.
Yeah. They started it first. The Immokalee workers, the garment workers around the world, field workers in a group called Via Campesina, which is a farm workers organization, predominantly female around the world, have been talking about sexual violence in the fields, and hotel workers and restaurant workers. So I feel that, in a sense, the attention of the country has caught up with what these women have been demanding for a long time. And I can only hope that Me Too is now going to, you know, enable some of these working women to get what they are hoping for. And I want to say that the women organizing around the world are not just organizing around sexual harassment and sexual violence, but other women's issues, too. Everywhere I went and I asked people why they were organizing, and this is garment workers, farm workers, hotel workers, fast food workers, they said, we want to fight pregnancy discrimination in the workplace, we want equal pay with men, and we want equal representation in our unions, as well as freedom from sexual violence. So it's really a women's movement, this labor movement, in many, many ways.
And what would you say we need to do on a systemic front? Is it about enforcement, or do we need new pieces of legislation and mandates within the workplace to deal with these issues wherever they arise?
We need both. We need both. We need enforcement of existing regulations. We need to test Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which guarantees, you know, women freedom from discrimination in the workplace. And indeed, these complaints that are going into the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission right now echo those that were first brought in 1965 when the EEOA was created. And they were expecting to get racial complaints. What they got overwhelmingly in those first years was complaints about sexual assault and harassment in the workplace. They were shocked, and they didn't quite know how to handle them. So that raises the next question. Laws are blurry. You know, Title IX's protection in, on campuses against hostile environment, right? That those are blurry, and women are using them, and they have to use them to try to improve their situation. But I think the hands-off, pants-on ordinances in places like Miami Beach and Chicago and Seattle are really important. We do need new laws as well as enforcement of existing laws.
By the way, I just wanted to ask you, I must have missed it. What does RAIN stand for?
Oh, gosh. It's I wrote about it in Rethinking Women's Activism, but it's the Reporting Abuse Information Network, something like that.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the substance of that. You mentioned it in passing, and it's not something I was familiar with, and obviously should be.
Well, coming out of the last round of women's organizing around sexual violence in the 1970s, or not the last, I mean, it's been going on ever since then, but, you know, kind of the last grassroots uprising around these issues and politicizing violence against women, you began to get national networks, national information networks and, you know, battered women shelters and rape crisis hotlines. And, you know, it is that infrastructure, some of which has been taken over by cities and states and, you know, got a lot of federal funding as a result of the Violence Against Women Act in 1994. All of that has paved the way for a lot of the kinds of institutions that a corporation like McDonald's can now turn to train, you know, to do trainings of their supervisors and their managers. And I think that's, I mean, we're dealing with it on my own campus. That is where we need to be right now. There are many other things we need, including genuine zero tolerance, but absolutely to, you know, preventative measures. You need to have managers and supervisors, whether it's a Ivy League college or at a McDonald's, who are trained so that they understand fully what is not acceptable, what kinds of behavior are not okay. It is not okay to say you don't have a good sense of humor, boys will be boys, right? These are violations of the rights of your workers, and you cannot do that.
And just tell us why, because I don't think a lot of more bourgeois or indeed left people of the male persuasion understand that. Why is that so offensive? It should be obvious, but apparently it isn't, because certainly the question is whether we are regressing or socially progressing, and how we take these issues home to our own workplace.
Well, I think that much as things have changed, there are certain things that haven't, and I think in this moment when, you know, the long anti-feminist backlash, right, has brought us elements of our popular culture that are decidedly hostile toward women and sexualizing the bodies of even very young women and girls. And, you know, and you walk into a workplace. Now, I think you're right that you should understand that it is offensive and it is a hostile environment. But in 1965, when these sexual harassment charges first started to be brought to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, you had the New York Times running an editorial that said, oh, come on, banning, you know, sexual banter and sexual harassment in the workplace, you might as well just try to ban sex. It's not going to happen. And obviously, despite the Anita Hill moment, you know, when the country became aware that sexual harassment doesn't only happen in blue-collar environments, it doesn't only happen in low-wage work, it happens in, you know, federal offices and, you know, in elite universities. Even after that, right, this has continued, and we have these cultures that are endemic to various workplaces. And I think it is time for everyone to understand what the phrase hostile environment means. It is an environment in which it is overly stressful for any worker who's being harassed. Hostile environment is what we're fighting, and it's what the McDonald's workers strike to say no more.
All right. Annalise Orlach, professor of history at Dartmouth College, author of We Are All Fast Food Workers Now, The Global Uprising Against Poverty Wages. Oh, you've got to come back and talk to us a good deal more. Thank
She's
you so much.
So many books. This is just skimming the surface.
Well, the energy, the empathy, and setting us straight on who has started the movements. And it is our sisters in the low-wage industries. Annalise, thank you. It's been great speaking with you.
I also want to thank the Fight for 15 movement for bringing up this issue with a one-day strike nationwide.
Yep, we all got to internalize our politics in every one of our work sites. You'll hear more about that. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here and There, audio postcards from Earth on Tuesday, October 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at OMSI in Portland.
Here and There, audio postcards from Earth is an all-ages and ability-inclusive event featuring nature sounds and field recordings in immersive surround sound from scientists and artists local and abroad from some of the world's most remote locations.
Listen to these places while sitting under the shifting stars from that time and place in nature's memory. Again, that's Here and There, audio postcards from Earth on Tuesday, October 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at OMSI, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue, Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on your community-supported radio, KBOO Portland. This is your host, Deb Stedman, and my guest today is Michael Budke, a co-founder of SANE, or Stop Animal Exploitation Now, which is a watchdog organization that monitors research facilities for illegal activities and animal abuse. Thanks a lot for coming on the program today, Michael.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay. Hey, Michael, many animal activists have some sort of experience in their lives that prompt them to become animal defenders.